I join you in welcoming Terry to Club 12 and look forward to her story. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And by the way, happy birthday. There we go. Is my volume okay now?
Now it is.
Yes. All right. All right. So happy anniversary to the group. And thank you again for inviting Rick and I to take part in this. It's been fun to sit in on the meetings and hear about the history of this club. It's really been so important over the years is to fall in with the group of winners. I can tell that this club grows a lot of winners. So thank you for what you've been doing. I am an Al-Anon, a very grateful Al-Anon. I've been a member of this fellowship since January 10th, 1989. I've got a few years on Rick. That's okay. Actually, he had a few years of bouncing around this program, and I thought that was just fine, that he could do that. I didn't need it. And when I did need it, I was glad, very glad it was there. Excuse me. That my favorite phrase, that comes from something my sponsor used to say, which was, you know, nothing changes if nothing changes. And that just capsulizes what has happened for me. I was desperate to have things be different, but I wanted things to be different with everyone else out there. And it quickly became apparent that I was the one who needed to change. I came from a family of, my parents were really a lot of fun. My mom, I would compare her to, the Lucy, and my dad's probably closer to Sheriff Andy Taylor, which meant we had fun. We did fun real well in my family, but we didn't necessarily deal with the serious stuff. And so I grew up in expecting life to always be fun. And I always looked for fun. I never thought I was necessarily the person I didn't like being center of attention, but I liked being around people who liked being, you know, front and center. And my parents were that way, and the person that I married was that way. And I always thought that to have fun, I had to be with other people to have fun, that on my own, I just, you know, couldn't do anything. And that kind of led me through a lot of the decisions I made. The reading that from How Al-Anon Works comes from a chapter, well, all throughout that book. I love it because one of the main sentiments throughout the book, How Al-Anon Works, is this underlying statement of alcoholics act and we react. My story is totally about my reactions to things outside of me. And a lot of that was reacting to people, even before I was fully engaged in this, in the craziness that goes along with alcoholism. Even before that happened, I was, you know, I reacted. I didn't take responsibility for myself. So for me, I went back up and say what I usually start out this way. And I don't know. It's weird talking from home. I don't know. It just feels different. So, but, Al-Anon for me is not someone who is married to or gave birth to or has a friend that's an alcoholic. And Al-Anon is someone who has found a program of recovery for themselves, who practices the 12 steps, who goes to meetings and is active in the program. So for me, that's what an Al-Anon is. I didn't realize that when I came to my first meeting. I thought that I was going to walk in and be told, you know, give the list. I think that's kind of the common experience. Give me the list of things I need to do so I can get him or her to do what I need them to do so that I will be okay. And that was the story of my life. Instead, the only list that I saw was up on the walls, and it was these 12 steps and 12 traditions. I was like, oh, I don't want that. I mean, it's like I thought I'd fallen into some kind of a cult or something. It was like, great. You know, now what have I done? I'm in a real jam now. You know. when I met Rick, he didn't drink, but he was one of these really interesting, different kind of people. As I said, I didn't think I was interesting on my own, so I always had to have someone else around me. So he was interesting, the air quotes. He was interesting. Yeah, he was a musician. He seemed to know everyone in that community where we lived in West Texas, and he was just very outgoing. And just, I thought, okay, this is fun. This will be fun. I had no interest in really being settled down and getting married or anything at that point. I was, you know, it's just like, this is someone fun to hang out with. And we did. We hit it off great. We talked a lot. We had fun. And he didn't drink. But he told me he had a problem with drugs and alcohol, which I thought was kind of exciting. This was somebody who had a past. You know, it's like, oh, that sounds exciting. but I had not seen him. I had not seen him drunk, and it would be several years before I ever experienced that. But he was for West Texas, he was an unusual character. He was a vegetarian, and he followed this Eastern tradition of meditation. And so he, like I said, he was interesting. He was different from most of the people I knew. And so we dated for 2 years and we married. And of course I'm a follower. So I became a vegetarian. I started doing, you know, the same form of meditation that he did. I may have been a follower, but I never gave myself 100% to what, you know, it was like, okay, I'm doing this just to go along. At one point, we'd been married for a couple of years, and we started our family pretty early, pretty quickly after we married. And Rick came from work one day and said, you know, I've been thinking that we should start drinking wine. I thought, yeah, that sounds good to me. You know, it sounds very sophisticated. And again, I was always looking to something to change me, something from outside of me to change me. I thought, well, that would be very sophisticated. So yes, let's drink wine. And so he brought home a bottle of wine and a couple of wine glasses, and he has had some book. Everything that happened in our lives, pretty much we had books for. We're avid readers, and Rick, you know, would always get books. And if you ever looked at our book collection, sometimes you see how schizophrenic we were. You know, there's something to go with every phase of our lives. So but anyway, so we had that bottle of wine. Rick opened it and poured some for me and poured some for himself. And so I drank the little bit, and I'm a mom of two toddlers. I'm exhausted. That was all I needed. I just went to bed. That was it. Got up the next morning, and I happened to kind of look around, and I said, where's the rest of the wine? And Rick said, oh, wine doesn't keep. So I had to finish it. I didn't know. You know, I'm clueless. I'm just gullible. It's like, oh, okay. So we're off and running. I didn't even realize it. The disease was right there in my house, and I didn't realize it. And it took several years before I knew what was going on. I tried all kinds of cures and fixes. You know, it's like, well, he needs to go see a doctor. He needs to go do this. We did the geographical cures, and we would move. You know, maybe he needs to change jobs. Maybe I need to, you know, it was just always something out there trying to fix it, trying to make it different. At one of our geographical cures, we started running a business for my parents. They bought a little business in Bryan College Station, a restaurant supply. And so here we are working for my parents, and most of our customers had bars. Some of them were nothing but bars. Perfect job for Rick. You know, he could go out, call on the, he could have these business calls and be in a bar all night. And, you know, I would get the call from the bar from one of the managers where I'd say, come pick him up, or I'm going to call the police to come get him out of here. And I would load up the kids and go pick up this drunk man. I didn't know what to do. You know, one more time. While we were there in that, running that business, which was just, I was caught in the middle between trying to do a good job for my parents and trying to manage, you know, and trying to hide and cover up for the alcoholic who's not doing a good job of running this business that we had been trusted with. But at one point, we were even 12-step by one of the salesmen who called on us. I realized later that he was 12-stepping us. He had been in recovery for quite a while. And he took us out to dinner, started telling us his story. And, you know, I was fascinated. It's like, wow, what an interesting story. That obviously didn't take. Rick continued to drink for a few more years. What finally got me into the program, I think Rick shared last night about his best friend kind of 12-stepping him and Rick reluctantly going to meetings. I didn't think I needed anything. As long as Rick got sober, that'd be fine. As long as he's doing that thing, I'm fine. But Rick had a relapse and I didn't know what to do. And I picked up the phone and I called that friend and told him. So Rick has had a relapse and I think had even wound up in jail at that point. And he said, well, what does Al-Anon tell you to do? I didn't know. I'd never been to Al-Anon. So I lied. I made something up. And then I felt a great deal of shame for that later. And so I finally did show up in an Al-Anon meeting. But because of that incident of him being in jail, we had joined a church at this point, you know, one more time trying to fix. We joined a church and I had to call the pastor because Rick was supposed to help serve communion the next day. And I had to call him and he said, when Rick gets out of jail, I want you to talk to some people that do you know. And he gave me the names of this couple. And I said, no, I don't know them. He said, well, he's very active in Alcoholics Anonymous and his wife would like to talk to you. So the preacher set up a meeting for us. And we walked in and we met the couple that became our sponsors. And she is still my sponsor today. And he was Rick's sponsor until years ago. They meant a lot to us. But this was like November or December. And I didn't make it to my first meeting until January because I was busy. Being busy was one of my coping mechanisms. It was one of my tools, staying busy. You know, I have kids to raise. I'm working on, you know, I'll get around to Al-Anon one of these days. And so when I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, my recollection of my first Al-Anon meeting was walking into a really dingy, you know, just yucky kind of brown room. They still smoked in the meetings in those days. And so the walls were kind of tobacco stained or whatever, you know, I'm not sure when the furniture had last been cleaned. And I thought, oh my goodness. And then of course I saw the 12 steps on the wall and I'm like, what am I doing here? Why am I here? But I agreed to stay, you know, to give it a try. And, it became part of our lives. Then we were going to meetings. The Al-Anon meetings were at the same time as AA meetings. So twice a week we went to our meetings and then on Friday night was an open AA meeting. And from the very beginning, I was going to open AA meetings. We did that a lot. There were a lot of couples that went to open AA meetings. I'm so glad because I had to sit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and hear shared the very same things that Rick maybe had said to me, but I didn't trust him anymore. But I had to hear it from someone else. When I came into Al-Anon, I was I like to say I was numb. I was frozen. And I gradually began to thaw out. I fell into a group of winners in Al-Anon. We started working the steps almost immediately, and I'm very grateful for that. Within the first 6 months of being there, two men came through the Midland-Odessa area that did a big book study, Joe and Charlie. And we went to that. And I heard there, once again, so much of what has happened for me in my recovery has happened because I've been willing to sit in a room with alcoholics and hear what they had to say and hear them share their program. And it was there listening to Joe and Charlie, I realized this was a divinely inspired program. And I could accept that. I'm sorry, our lawn service just showed up. I hope that's not going to be a problem. Oh, great. Life in a pandemic, right? So anyway, so I like I said, I fell into a group of winners, began working the steps for myself. I also heard that we keep the focus on ourselves and not on the alcoholic. began to work the steps with my sponsor, began to be open and willing to do it. And through the years, I've discovered some things in working the steps. You know, step one for me looked like it wasn't so much that my behaviors necessarily were unmanageable, but my thinking and feelings were making my life unmanageable. And I began to identify that in step one. And then in step two, I began to identify what is my heart's desire? What is the desire? What is it that I'm longing for? That allowed me to start considering that and actually owning that. It wasn't dependent on what others were doing outside of me. It became my own. Step three, open the door to help. I was willing to open the door to God's help. That was something I'd always believed in God, but I thought God was very distant, wasn't right there for me. And I thought God was only there for the big, major stuff. And step three also allowed me to begin getting out of my own way. It's like, okay, I'm stepping back now and turning my will and my life over to this higher power I've come to know. And I'm getting out of the way now. Step four, that's based on the principle of courage. And I became willing and interested in taking the time to get to know who I was. I could tell you all about everyone else in my life, what my kids needed, what my husband needed, what my parents needed, you know, what my neighbors, you know, anything. But I could not tell you what I needed. And I began to, in step four, I became aware of who I was and what it was that, just knowing myself. Step five, always love, you know, sharing with God and another human being, with ourselves and another human being. I always found it worked totally opposite for me. I had to share it with another human being. Then I could hear it. And then when I could hear it, then I could experience God. So for me, it came through in a kind of a reverse pattern. Step six is where I became willing to give up the constant struggle to be someone else. I don't know if that's just a matter of age now or what it is, but I like who I am today. I'm not trying to be someone else. I'm okay with just being Terry. Step seven is the action through prayer. I'm giving all of me to this higher power I've come to know through the steps. And then step eight, that's the principle of brotherly love. I don't know that I always loved other people. I maybe wanted to please them to get them to love me, but I wasn't so much concerned about extending and sharing myself with them. So step eight has given me the opportunity to do that. And when I practice that, I'm freeing myself from the guilt and shame of that came from not being my authentic self. So being more authentic. And step nine, making choices about the kind of person I want to be and the relationships I want to have. I do this when I can make amends and be fully ready to be different in that relationship. What a gift. That's an amazing gift to have. Step 10, self-honesty and compassion. This is where I look at what joys have I experienced. I don't necessarily do this at night. It can be just at any moment during the day. When I experience a joy, I can go, oh, thank you. Thank you to this higher power that I have joy in my life. I believe that I've always had joy, that joy is always present. I just need to look for it. And so step 10 gives me the opportunity to do that. Step 11, if there's time to worry, I love this. If there's time to worry, there's time to pray, right? I had that totally, out of balance. It was like, no, if I worry a whole lot, then when my extreme worry doesn't accomplish anything, then I might pray about it. And it's like, okay, remember, if I have time to worry, I have time to pray. And step 12 is just all about being living my life on life's terms. those are the lessons I've learned over the 31 years that I've been in Al-Anon. And what those lessons have given me has been a full life. And by life, I don't mean just it hasn't been a bed of roses, as you heard in Rick's story last night. There have been some difficulties. You know, the time when he was in prison, that was difficult. We had to go through a trial, and in that community where we were like the lead story on the 6 o'clock news for the offense that Rick was arrested for. And that was difficult. We had teenage sons, and trying to help them navigate through the embarrassment and the shame that goes along with everyone in the community knowing what's going on. I mean, and we certainly weren't, certainly was no secret anymore that there was alcoholism in our family. You know, it's like, well, it's kind of like there was a certain freedom that came from that. It's like, okay. I've been in Al-Anon for about 3 or 4 years when that happened. When Rick went to prison, I had to come to terms with the reality that we learn about through the steps of my life. And it's like the reality was I could very well be, I might very well be the only source of income from then forward, you know, because what happens to felons, to ex-convicts, they're not always employable. So I had to look at some things. The first thing I did was work at paying off any debt that we had. And I did, you know, I was able to do that. During the course of that time also, our sons are teenagers, and they're doing what teenagers do. And the older son had really gotten my attention with some of his behaviors, and I was super focused on him, trying, you know, and at one point he wound up going to treatment a couple of times. During this time, our younger son, Adam, had always been a really good student, and he was the one who was going to make our family look good. Even though I was in Al-Anon, I still suffered from that how do we look to the rest of the world type thing. So here we are, we've got someone going to prison. You know, I've got an older son who can't seem to do well in school or stay in school and is struggling and getting in trouble. And so I had every expectation that Adam would continue to be a good student and redeem me as a mother. That's bottom line. That's what it comes down to. I had a lot of guilt and shame about whether I was a good mother or not, because somehow if I was a good mother, my children wouldn't be struggling. I suffer from this delusion that everything is okay, right? They're going to be all right. I don't have to really look at this. Rick's over here. You know, I've got the older son doing his thing. Adam's going to make everything okay. So it was a real shock to me when I realized that Adam, not only was Adam experimenting with drugs and alcohol, he was in worse trouble than our older son. And so at one point, we had everyone going to treatment before he had a trial. Rick went to treatment, and then the older son went to treatment. Later, Adam went to treatment. So at one point, you know, I had everyone going same treatment center. So I said I should get like a wing named after me or something, because I could, you know, it's like, okay, who's going, who's where today? But I always thought, well, maybe I should get a couple of weeks there. You know, I need the rest. Because to me, it's like all I could see was that they were going to treatment. They were being taken care of. They were being fed and taken care of and everything. And I'm working, you know, and so a little bit of a resentment there. but anyway, I know now that sending people to treatment was an attempt for me to control things. And I don't think I had unrealistic expectations about what that would accomplish, but I do know that it allowed me to be able to sleep at night because I at least knew where whoever the current problem was, I knew where they were. So when I discovered that Adam had this, was in much worse shape than I realized, it brought me to my knees. And I had heard at the very first conference I ever went to in that very first year in 1989, I'd heard an Al-Anon speaker from Dallas, and she had talked about using the third step prayer and inserting the name of her son in the third step prayer to help her be able to let go of him. And so I started applying that in this case. And it was just, I mean, it was so much easier to let go of my alcoholic spouse than it was to let go of an alcoholic child. Because for one of my children to have problems with drugs and alcohol somehow was my fault. And I know logically that wasn't the case, but my heart, it took a long time for the head and the heart to get together. During this time I was going to my Al-Anon meetings, and one more time I was numb. That's my reaction to everything. I'm just numb. I don't feel my emotions. I was starting to feel numb, and I would go to those meetings and just, I was convinced Al-Anon wasn't working because I wasn't feeling anything. I thought it's not working. It's not working for me anymore, but I kept going because I didn't know what else to do. And one evening at the end of a meeting, as we're circled up and holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer, it was like the dam broke and I started crying. And I knew at that point that I was going to be able to continue my recovery. That's the scariest feeling, to be in that point of not feeling and feeling like it's not working. And what do I do now? So when I could finally break down and had those feelings and start crying, I knew I was going to be okay. And my connection was not harmed by anyone but me. I shut down. I didn't trust. I didn't want to feel. It was just all of the things that I'd done before I came into Al-Anon. So, Adam did eventually get sober, and the older son is getting married about this time. Rick is in prison, and Adam had gone from a treatment center to a halfway house for a while, and he wanted to come home for a visit. And I said, okay, you know, come, you can come visit me. And when he got there, he said, you know, I don't think I want to go back to the halfway house. I think I'd like to come back to Odessa and stay here. And I said, well, I don't have a problem with that, but I don't know that you and I should live together again. Because what happened to me when Adam was at his worst is that I felt as though I was drowning again. He would disappear for 2 or 3 days again. And I felt like I was drowning. I was trying to hold him up, trying to keep him from drowning. In the process, I was drowning. And I finally, being able to let go of him, I could save myself and let him do what he needed to do to save himself. So I was worried that having him back in the house with me might trigger some of that. But we talked about it, and it worked out, and he stayed with me. So for the next year or so, he and I lived there. He helped start a young people's meeting in Odessa. And he was employed, gainfully employed. Woohoo! Always like that, you know. And the older son at this point was married, and I had dinner with them one evening, and they told me that they were expecting a baby, and they told me it was going to be a girl. I was like, yes, God loves me. We're going to get a girl in the family. It's like, hallelujah. I think it's great. She's here just for me. She's mine. So things were good. And I also decided to go back to school during this time. As I said, I knew that the reality of an alcoholic ex-con trying to get a job. And so I decided to pursue a graduate degree. And I did that during this time. So I paid off I'd gotten us in pretty good financial shape. You know, Adam and I were, we'd made amends, and we had a really good relationship. Our relationship was very strong, and it was just terrific. And I was going to visit Rick in prison every month, and usually one of the sons would go with me, depending on who was available and could go. And when I would go visit Rick, I could see that he was being of maximum service there, and he had sobriety, and I hadn't seen him have this level of sobriety for this length of time, and that was really encouraging, and I was happy for him for that reason. But I was also really concerned about him getting released, because my life was good, and I didn't know if I wanted to have him back in the house with me. I didn't necessarily want to divorce him, but I just didn't know, just like with Adam, I just didn't know if that was the healthiest choice for me. Here I was getting to make choices for myself. So I started talking to my sponsor about it. And she said, all you can do is just be honest and tell Rick that. And so I did, you know, on one of my visits, I told him, and he was very understanding about it. And, but as it turned out, he got out and he came home, and it was good. And Adam was there with us for a little while before Adam decided he was a musician and in a band, and they were going to move to Louisiana. And I said, yeah, I think that's great. You're 18. I mean, if you're ever going to do this, this is the time to do it. He had a job lined up. He was working as an electrician. And I said, I think that's great. You should go ahead and do it. So he moved. And then during this time, Rick began to feel called to go into ministry, which go to seminary, which I have to tell you, he had mentioned this a few years before everything happened and he went to prison. He had said, you know, I'm thinking maybe I'd like to be a minister, be a pastor. And I was like, oh, no, you know, I'm not going to raise our kids in a fishbowl like that. You know, no, I can't, you know, and I had said no. And of course, you know, what, a month or two later, we're the lead story on the 6 o'clock news. So they're talking about, you know, I got a fishbowl one way or the other. So anyway, this time I said, yeah. I can see that. I think you've been called. I said, but here's my concern. I can see you being a pastor. I can't see me being a pastor's wife. You know, I'm an Al-Anon, and that's what I know about this higher power that I call God today, is through Al-Anon. And Rick gave me a great gift at that time. He said, Terry, you're not called to be anything but who you are. And that's what you bring. You bring being an Al-Anon wherever you are. And I thought, okay, I can do that. All right. So we sold this home that I had spent, you know, it had looked like an alcoholic home until I finally got everyone out of the house and I could fix it up. You know, we had the holes that were punching the wall and the cabinet doors that were falling off, and you know, it was bad. And so I had spent that time kind of fixing the home up and making it something that brought me joy. So we sold that home. We moved to Austin to go to seminary. It was really hard because I had always had the same home group all these years. And it was very scary for me to think about leaving my home group in Odessa. But a year or two before, someone from my home group had moved to Austin. So I thought, great, I'll go to the same meetings that Polly goes to in Austin. So I did. I had that immediate connection. We got through seminary. I always introduced myself as, hi, I'm the heathen, or hi, I'm the paycheck. You know, he's the seminary student. We got through that. It was a good experience. It really was. And then we moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. So here we were, even further from my comfort zone, and I knew no one in Charlotte Al-Anon. And I thought, okay, I'm getting, you know, God's going to have to take care of this one for me, because I don't know what. Our very first Sunday there, and when Rick goes to a church, he always tells them right up front that he's an alcoholic with a felony record. I mean, he, you know, no sense surprising with that information later, right? So they knew up front. And so we showed up, and this woman came walking up to me and to Rick and I both and said, my parents have been in AA and Al-Anon for over 40 years at that time. And I was like, oh, thank you, God. Now I know. And she immediately connected us with her parents, and I had meetings to go to. I wound up later sponsoring that same woman in the church, but that was kind of neat. So wherever we've moved, we've always immediately gotten plugged into our 12-step family. I mean, that's the constant for us. We may move. We may be affiliated with a church. We may, you know, my jobs may change, whatever, but the constant is always this 12-step family that I'm a part of. And I'm so grateful that I am a part of that. After we moved to Dallas, we, as Rick shared last night, we had a lot of things going on. You know, my mother had an incurable illness. And so we were a little bit closer. They lived outside the Austin area. And then Adam was living in Austin, had married at this point. Our other son now had two children, and they lived in Abilene. So, you know, Dallas is good. We could get close to all the family. And then we moved Rick's parents in with us. And we were in Austin at one point to see my mom, who was in the hospital. I got a phone call from Adam's wife that Adam was in the emergency room of another hospital in Austin. So we drove across the city, and he had been found in a car. He had overdosed. And we walked in and saw my daughter-in-law. And I said, so, you know, have you seen Adam? She said, I saw when they brought him in. I said, well, I'm going to go back and talk to him. So I walked back there and I told the nurse who I was. She said, oh, great. And she handed, you know, she had the papers, and she said, we'll have him ready for discharge. And I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do with him? You know, I was like, you know, I'm just his mom. I don't want to, you know, I'm just here to say hi or whatever. So next thing you know, I've got Adam in a wheelchair wheeling him out. And his wife gave him a kiss. She's boo-hooing and crying, and she left. And Rick and I are kind of like, okay, well, because we were connected to people in recovery in Austin, we knew that we knew how to help him get into another treatment facility. So we arranged that and came back to Dallas. And so Adam was down there, and it was time for him to leave that program. And we talked with him about maybe his wife hadn't gone to see him, didn't want anything to do anywhere to go. So we said he come to the Dallas area, and he could live in a sober living home somewhere. And so that was the plan. So we got his papers transferred up here and everything. And so he stayed with us, and the original plans, he'd stay with us for a short time and then get in a sober living home. But it worked out, and he wound up being with us for 6 months. And that was a special time, a time of some more healing between Adam and I, more healing between Adam and his dad, you know. And we drove, he had lost his license, had been revoked because of his DWIs. So we were driving into meetings. It gave me the opportunity to try out some different Al-Anon meetings. You know, we'd find groups where he could go to meetings and I could go to meetings. And so it gave me an opportunity to go around and visit different groups. And that was nice. But it became apparent that Adam was having trouble staying sober. He had reconnected with some old friends, and that scared me. And I told him it scared me. And he said, yeah, he admitted that it scared him too. He said, but they're being supportive of me. And I thought, okay. I mean, what can I say? He's 31, you know, it's like, I've got to let go. So as Rick shared, in April of 2010, Adam had to leave to do community service. And I knew he was lying about what his plans were and everything, but he was going to be gone for the weekend. And I knew it was a lie. And I went to bed that Saturday night, just very distressed. But this time I wasn't numb. I was feeling everything, and I was distressed, and I was worried. And I remember laying in that bed and doing the third step prayer over and over and being so desperate. I was like, God, I truly have to let go of Adam. Please help me to let go of him. And I tossed and turned and tossed and turned. And so then the next day, when we got the phone call that Adam had died earlier that morning, and I did scream, I did yell. We were there in the church, and I probably said a lot of things that aren't appropriate to be said in a church. And I'll make my amends by not doing that anymore ever again. But anyway, it was hard. It was really hard. And I began to shut down. And I my overwhelming feeling was to be angry at God. It's like I finally let go of Adam. I really and truly let go of him, and this is what you did. You took him from me. So I didn't want to call my parents and tell them my mom was, you know, I knew she was in the last stages. I didn't want to tell them over the phone. So I called my brother and sister who live in the same little town and told them and asked them to go tell my parents in person. And they did. And I had to call our other son and tell him. And then I called my sponsor. And man, she didn't leave me alone a single day. She called me every single day. And some of the women I sponsored were calling me every single day. And the days where I felt like taking the calls, I would take them. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't always want to talk to someone, but it meant a lot to know they were willing to try to reach me. So we got through the services. And then my mother died 3 days after Adam. I like to think that Adam was there to greet her. They were always really close. You know, he loved her harebrained schemes, and she thought he was just the cutest, funniest thing, and they always had a special thing together. So I like to think that he was there to greet her, which, yeah. Anyway, so we had talked with Adam about coming to the International in San Antonio, and you know, July's coming around. It's like, well, let's go ahead and do it. We already had the arrangements, and so we decided to do it. That was the first international. All these years, our sponsors have been telling us, oh, you need to save up your money and plan to go to international. We'd always been busy. There's always been a reason we couldn't go. So he said, there's no real excuse not to go. So we went. And I spent the first day or so walking around seeing all these young men about Adam's age, sober, and the convention. And it was hard. I'd go back to my room. I'd want to cry. I was trying really hard to be okay in that moment and to be happy for these young men that were sober. And I was. But I was also like, that should have been my son. I was still in that phase of that should have been Adam there. I had signed up to help at the Al-Anon. Al-Anon has some workshops and sessions going on concurrently during the AA sessions in a different hotel, and I'd signed up to be a greeter. So I went over there to do my, to fulfill my commitment. And while I was there, I thought, well, I really should go to one of these workshops, you know, while I'm here. And so I just picked one randomly. It was called Trusting God's Plan for My Life. And I thought, why not? I don't trust God for anything. Let me just go to this and see what happens, you know. And so I did, and I didn't know a soul in that room. And I sat down since I didn't know anyone, I didn't have anyone sitting next to me. There was an empty chair beside me, and that's fine. And the way they did it is a panel of three people who shared for 10 minutes each, and then they would open it up to the floor for sharing. So the first woman who shared talked about being the daughter of an alcoholic preacher. Well, I'm married, you know, to an alcoholic preacher. The next woman who shared talked about being a grandmother, and she had a granddaughter named Caitlin. That's our granddaughter's name, is Caitlin. And then the third person who spoke, the third woman who spoke, lovely Irish accent. And she works for, but I think she was living in England. But anyway, she was there for international. And she introduced herself, and her name was Lula. Lula was my mother's given name. And I don't know what else was said. Just in their introductions, I was already blown away. I don't know what was said for the rest of that workshop. I don't know what anyone shared from the floor. All I know is that chair that was empty next to me was suddenly filled with my higher power. My higher power was going, see, I'm here. I think everyone who was in that workshop that day heard what they needed to hear. I happened to hear mine just when the people introduced themselves. You know, go figure. go figure. I can't gauge how God works in this, but that's how God worked for me. And I couldn't wait to go see my sponsor. Our sponsors were there for the international. That was the last one they got to go to. And couldn't wait to go see her. And we sat there on the Riverwalk eating ice cream and just boohooing, you know, as I told her the story. And it was so special. Now, I gradually began to thaw out again, began to come to terms with this higher power that had taken. Listen to me, how arrogant is that? I used to think when I realized that Adam was an alcoholic, my first reaction was like, no, God, not this one. I deserve one who doesn't have this. I deserve one. That was the level of my arrogance. I was trying to tell God what I deserved and what I didn't deserve. So I was starting to come to terms with this higher power who I realized wasn't trying to punish me. I think that it was just, I don't know. I don't know why Adam had to leave when he left, but I do know that he was received by a higher power who loved him. Even though Adam maybe couldn't come to terms with his disease and with his relationship with his higher power, I do believe in the moment of Adam's passing that the higher power was there for him. So one of the things that I grieved the most was I felt like my family was finite at that point. My surviving son had his two children, and that was it. I was never going to get to have grandchildren through Adam. You know, I was never. So it's like, okay, suddenly my family has been reduced to a very small family. And I always regretted that I didn't have more grandchildren. So we had gone to Abilene to celebrate Caitlin's 16th birthday. And we had gone out to a restaurant, and we're finishing our meal, and my daughter-in-law reached over and handed me a card. And I thought, well, this is not my birthday yet. My son said, well, you might want to be sure you're completely finished eating before you open it. And it's like, what? What are you talking about? So I opened it, and inside was a sonogram picture. And I kind of did this. It's like, well, I know Caitlin. Surely Caitlin's not pregnant. And I looked over, my daughter-in-law has tears streaming down her face. They're pregnant. My son and his wife are having another baby. They didn't think they could have more children. And it turns out it's going to be a little boy. God gave me another little boy in my life to love. That was one of the greatest things. And at that point, I knew that God loved me enough to be sure that we got to have another beautiful little boy in our family. And so today, Colton is 7, and his parents may think that he's here for them, but he's not. He's here for me. I don't tell them that. That's just between us. But I think that he was sent. By this time, I had also lost my dad, and I believe that my parents and my son got to hold Colton and smother him with all kinds of kisses before he got here for me to get to hold. And so I think he came here with a whole lot of love surrounding him. So anyway, so we have this really funny situation now where we've got a granddaughter who is 23, getting married next May, a grandson who just turned 20, and then the 7-year-old from the same set of parents. I love that my higher power has a sense of humor because, you know, that he finds ways to keep me amused and to make sure that I have fun no matter what. So life has joys, life has blessings, life has grief. Life has things that will bring me to my knees. But because I have a recovery family, because I have a program, because I get to live in a sober home today, there's not anything that is going to separate me from that higher power I've come to know here. There's not anything that's going to separate the people I love from that. I believe that higher power loves everyone I love a million times more than I could possibly. And when I can focus on that, that, you know, what do I have to complain about? Today, I don't have to worry about, is Adam in jail again? Is Adam going to be able to stay sober? You know, I've been through that. It's okay. I'm at peace now with the fact that Adam left us earlier than I would have liked. Whenever I have the opportunity to tell my story, it's really hard. And I have some friends in my home group who have gone through some losses, who have lost children too. And we always talk about, we wish we had different stories to tell. And I hesitate sometimes for it to be the story. You know, I wish I had a different story to tell, but that is my story. And I don't know what comes next for anyone in my family. But I know that as long as groups like yours stay together, and groups like the groups that Rick and I are members of, that anyone in my family who needs the help can get it. And that means the world to me. So congratulations again, 71 years, that's remarkable. And thank you for having us. I really do appreciate it. Thank you.